please the court. My name is Norman Thomas, and I represent Aisha Raj Anija. Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
All right.
Ms. Anija appeals from the partial denial of her petition for expungement. She was charged back in January of 2014 with felonious assault of a law enforcement officer. In April of that year, she went to the General District Court of the jurisdiction. It was in Williamsburg, James City County. And the charge was amended to disorderly conduct, which she pled and received a sentence. She later petitioned for expungement, relying principally on the Dressner v. Commonwealth decision, in that the felonious charge had been amended and that the disorderly conduct charge to which she pled was not a lesser included offense of the felony. She then presented evidence. The trial court denied the petition on this particular matter, ostensibly under the manifest injustice issue. Yet when it did so, it didn't discuss her evidence. In fact, it looked back instead of at the present and in the future. It looked back at the circumstances surrounding her arrest and the circumstances surrounding the amendment of the warrant. And Ms. Anija's position before the court today is that when the court did that, it departed from the language of 19.2392.2F, which describes the hearing which is to take place on the manifest injustice issue. That statute bears on the current and future ability of a petitioner to obtain credit, to obtain an education, and it does not look back at employment, and it does not look back to the facts and circumstances. In fact, in the Daniel decision, which is a key decision in this case, we contend, the court made it very clear that a trial judge necessarily must look back to the facts and circumstances of the warrant and of the trial to determine how it ended. Was it acquittal, a nul pros, or was it otherwise dismissed within the meaning of subpart A of the statute? And the court was also clear that the trial court is limited in that analysis to the stated basis on how that charge was resolved. Then, in describing the next step in the process after the threshold determination of potential expungibility has been determined, only then does the court go to subpart F's hearing.
So would the, under your logic, Ms. Thomas, would we remand it and say, look, you actually did the manifest injustice standard wrong because you misunderstood that there was an otherwise dismissal because of the substitution of a non-lesser included for a different charge. Refocus your attention on the going forward facts, or are you asking us to make that call here?
We are asking you emphatically to make that call here. And that is why we went to the court's library and pulled the Brown record. And it's down in the library right now, and I pulled it again yesterday and reread the whole thing. Ms. Anija's evidence is surpassing of Mr. Brown's evidence in that case, and the court ruled in that case that Mr. Brown's evidence, as a matter of law, was sufficiently strong to meet the manifest injustice inquiry.
The logic there would be if you strip out the arguably mistaken threshold issues as to whether or not the substitution of the one charge for another is a de facto dismissal. If you strip that out and look only at the manifest injustice, no rational fact finder could disagree on that?
That's our position in light of the Brown's decision that, as a matter of law, his evidence was sufficient. We understand that the court could remand this and direct the trial judge to accept this court's instruction on the issue and upon the charge being potentially expungible, now focus only on the manifest injustice issue. What the existence of that information and its dissemination does or may do to this young lady's ability to obtain the education, employment, and credit that she may seek in the future. Yet you can imagine, Your Honor, the trepidation that this client has about going back in front of that judge and the concern that with that particular judge having stated on page 66, essentially this appendix, that no evidence would ever be good enough on the manifest injustice issue. She doesn't want to go back there. And I submit that's understandable, but it's only justifiable if her evidence, as a matter of law, is sufficient to meet it, to meet the manifest injustice standard that this court can declare it to be so. And that is why we went back and researched that Brown case. We do commend that to the court, that appendix in that case, because it was another case like this one where the trial court just didn't want to grant the expungement, even though the charge was potentially expungible. So it articulated its rebellion, if you will, through the manifest injustice standard. And the court reversed and indicated that that just was not the correct approach to take. And that's when the court also looked at her evidence, or excuse me, Mr. Brown's evidence, and found as a matter of law that it was sufficient. And I suppose it's important at this point for me to comment on the evidence that Ms. Anija did present. She articulated that with her Disney ABC position, an internship, that upon the disclosures that she made about her prior criminal history, when it was researched, and of course they only asked for convictions, but when they researched her prior criminal history, they found this charge. And they delayed her start date for 10 days. Now, it's true, as the Commonwealth argued, that, well, she still got the internship. She got this $15 an hour internship at Disney ABC, yes, but it did delay it. And that type of event is predictive on the manifest injustice issue that this may be a problem for her in the future when, in this highly selective field of children's media production and marketing, she tries to take the next step up and gets a full-time position where she wants to be, which is at Disney Junior. She also...
Well, the statute is written in a fairly broad fashion because it talks about, it uses the word may. So that suggests potentiality as opposed to actuality.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The General Assembly wrote this particular section broadly, we submit, because it wanted those whose charges were potentially expungible under subpart A to have the benefit that the remedial benefit, if you will, that the General Assembly was prescribing in subpart F. So it's a light standard, no question about it.
Is it a light standard when they suggest that it has to, or it may show a manifest injustice? Those two terms together almost seem inconsistent, may and manifest injustice.
Manifest injustice
being a fairly high standard.
Well, we see manifest injustice used in a lot of places, both legislatively and judicially in the history of our jurisprudence. And yet, the manifest injustice has to be articulated or has to be understood in terms of 392.1, which is the statement of legislative policy.
I found that interesting, too. Hindrance is a low standard. Could it be a may it be?
Yes.
Might it be a hindrance? And then they throw in manifest injustice.
Your Honor, we know the General Assembly sometimes is not as particular in its wording as it might have been. But the genesis of what they're after is certainly there for us. That they want, whether it's a young person or an older person, not to be held back by an arrest that they never pled guilty to, they never were tried upon and convicted upon. And it's a, if you will, it's a fresh start type of provision.
But if we adopted that view, Mr. Thomas, and did it exactly as you ask us to do, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you would be asking us to say is, as a matter of law, manifest injustice under this statute means the potential that you may one day in the future have some employment opportunities reduced, even though there's no direct evidence of it and it's a reasonable inference, but there's no proof of it. That no rational fact finder, no judge in this Commonwealth could ever conclude otherwise, because that would be irrational.
Well, for our final relief in this case, Your Honor, that is what we're asking. But it is important to understand that Ms. Anija does not ask for the court to make new law here. But
well, that really would be new law, I would suggest, if we said that manifest injustice is always established as a matter of law. If you come into court and say, you know what, I got the job, but they hassled me, and I may have some employment opportunities reduced in the future.
We understand that every case is determined on its facts. And when it comes here, it's determined on its facts as well in that light.
Well, however, we're not fact finders. That's the problem with that.
Well, Your Honor, we do submit, and again, we refer back to the court's articulation in Brown v. Commonwealth, that if Mr. Brown's evidence was good enough as a matter of law, then Ms. Anija's evidence, surpassing in strength of Mr. Brown's, should be good enough as well. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
May it please the court, my name is Nathan Green. I'm the Commonwealth Attorney for the City of Williamsburg and James City County. The Commonwealth requests that this court affirm the decision of the Williamsburg-James City County Circuit Court denying the appellant's petition for expungement. We do so for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that there was no evidence of any circumstance or event of hindrance that would create a manifest injustice presented by Ms. Anija's evidence.
And counsel, you make that argument on page 13 of your brief, 13 and 14 of your brief, but in doing so, you misstate the law. And so you say, and I quote, for felony offenses, there must be some injustice created. And as Justice McCullough just pointed out, the standard is may. It's not must, it's may. So if someone is, it's not a high standard. But it looks to what might occur in the future. And you are indicating that there needs to be evidence of what will occur in the future.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth's position is that the legislative policy statement speaks to may. Well, our position would be that that is a...
I'm not looking at the legislative policy statement. I'm looking at the statute itself.
Yes, but the statute itself says, may create a circumstance of a manifest injustice. By also including manifest injustice, it does look at, even if there was some hindrance or some... If an employer did say, you can't have this job, does that in and of itself create a manifest injustice? As the manifest injustice has been used.
When you say, you are putting it into the past tense. You are saying an employer has said this, past tense. It has occurred. There's no doubt that it's occurred. When you use the term may, you are looking prospectively, that it may or it might or it could occur.
Yes, Your Honor.
Entirely different wording.
Yes, Your Honor. And what the Commonwealth would put forward is that there has to be some evidence that it may happen. For example, you have to bring in an employer who says, when we do background checks, if we see a felony arrest, regardless of what the outcome is, we would deny employment. You do not have to wait for her to actually apply for the job and be denied, but I believe there has to be some...
Do you have any employers handy that would come in and say that?
Pardon me?
Do you have any employers handy that would come in and say that?
No, but I think there has to be some meaning given to the language manifest injustice. Otherwise, the legislature would have just said, if you have a charge that you are not convicted of, it can be expunged or shall be expunged. I think
that would
there has
be
to be
the,
some meaning given to those words.
That would be the consequence, because if we were to say manifest injustice means it may happen, which is a percentage of probability, we don't know, it's a prediction, but the thing that may happen that bothers us is there may be some limitation on your employability. That would mean every time the potential expungement is available, there would be a right, an absolute right, because you could always say, manifest injustice is I may in the future have some unspecified, unquantified, unpredicted limitation to my employment, which we could probably take judicial notice of.
I would agree.
So it's got to be somewhere between those two.
Right. I mean, isn't the middle path, I mean, look at the facts here. So you have someone who's in a, she's not at McDonald's. She's in a media industry producing media for children. So that's the first thing. And she's also averred, she's contemplating law school. And, of course, law school has character and fitness and criminal background check. And in a context where she's a graduate of William & Mary, you know, and so on. So it's not like someone is here saying, well, I'm homeless now, but one day I'm going to go to, you know, Harvard Law School and then I'm going to get snagged on the character and fitness. So why isn't this factual allegation that middle ground that we're looking for, as opposed to just a purely theoretical notional form of prejudice?
Because I think we can look at the record. We can look at the 2014 arrest and conviction. And then we can look at her resume, which shows a May through August 2014 obtaining employment with the Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. June of 2015, obtaining employment with Paramount Pictures. December 2015 through January 2016, obtaining employment with Marie Claire. September 2016, obtaining employment with Disney ABC. There's zero evidence of her hindrance to obtaining employment. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. She continually obtains employment. As to education, she continually obtains education opportunities. In 2014, we have the conviction. In 2016, she graduates from William & Mary, having made the dean's list twice after the conviction. She's obtaining education opportunities at College of William & Mary. She obtains an education opportunity at Vienna University of Economic and Business. She's obtained it. She obtained that. She obtained the education opportunities at Google AdCamp Competitive Program. She obtained the educational opportunity at her campus in 2014 to 2016. The evidence on the record is not that there has been an hindrance at all. In fact, it's the opposite. She has continually not only attained education, she has continually obtained employment. The record is silent on whether or not she had any hindrance to credit, but I would argue that it was her burden to put forward this evidence, not the Commonwealth's burden to prove that she could get a credit. She proved that she could obtain and did obtain all of these employments and all these educational opportunities and put forward zero evidence that she did not, or that there was any hindrance to her ability to obtain education, employment, and so therefore, I would argue that there is no evidence of a manifest injustice. The delay at Disney, I disagree with counsel's assertions on the record. In my read of the record, on page 34, the answer was, so I had to disclose my criminal history, and when I did, my internship was moved to start, and I wasn't sure. It was moved for about a week to 10 days, and when I first disclosed, they said that I would need to wait to find out whether everything would be okay, and that just kind of surprised me, because the start date was moved. Follow-up question, so you had to disclose just convictions? Answer, yes. The disclosure of her convictions was what caused the delay. There is no evidence that ABC Disney ever found or ever did discover the felony arrest. The letter from Disney, which is on page 71 of the appendix, or the email from Disney, we are still pending approvals to get your cleared. This was because you disclosed something to Accurate. This is the disclosures that she made about her criminal convictions. There's no evidence that they ever even discovered this arrest or that it was the dissemination or the continued existence of the arrest record that delayed her start. As a matter of fact, the record's very clear that she says it was delayed when she revealed her convictions,
so
not the arrest.
In this type of circumstance, would a petitioner satisfy the burden under the May portion of the statute? Let's say bring in an HR expert to say, well, this kind of conviction is something that we look at and that we use as a filter. Because, you know, your argument goes to the, well, she hasn't shown any prejudice today, and I suppose we could extrapolate from that and say, well, that shows a likelihood of no prejudice in the future. I'm just trying to figure out how the plaintiff could satisfy that burden, and in particular, if she does cite two fairly rigorous character and fitness standards for, you know, a bar applicant.
Yes, but I think this court could also look to the fact that there are numerous attorneys that are numerous candidates for law school that get enrolled in law school with felony convictions, let alone a felony arrest, with misdemeanor convictions. There was no evidence from an admissions dean to say, we look at felony arrests, and if you have a felony arrest, there's not even any evidence that they would say we would consider that.
Counsel, you're not seriously suggesting that in order to meet this standard, or perhaps you are you seriously suggesting that to meet this standard, the applicant would have to bring in an HR person, a college admission or a law school admissions dean to say what the detriment would be on this application?
I don't know how else you can satisfy the evidence required that there is a hindrance that creates a manifest injustice. To do otherwise would be to rewrite the legislature's statute to say, if you are not convicted, you are entitled to have it expunged. And that's just not what they've said. They've said that there is a hearing to be held. And just to be held to say, I would like to have it expunged, then I guess you don't need to bring any evidence.
But I think that gets back to Justice McCullough's questions of a spectrum here. Certainly coming in and saying, I would like to have it expunged, wouldn't pass muster in any circuit court in Virginia that I can think of. But as I hear your argument, you would expect the applicant to bring in witnesses, put them on the stand, and they would say, if I looked at this record, I might think twice about hiring this candidate, or I would not hire this candidate.
I think there has to be some evidence of that. I do not think that can be
an evidence that the law school exam requires this fitness and competence information, and it may hinder her, in your opinion, would not be enough?
I don't know of any evidence that the existence
may.
But I don't know that any exists of that may. I know too many examples of individuals who have not just arrests, but convictions, who get into law school and who get admitted to the bar. I don't think that it is just a million monkeys with a million typewriters may reproduce the works of Shakespeare. It's a timing may.
I'm sorry, how many monkeys?
A million. But
does she present any evidence of law school applications that
no.
say, tell me if you've ever been arrested, even though we don't care that you weren't convicted?
No.
So that would be the easiest way to do it. Is this, I mean, every applicant, what about employment applications? Tell me if you've ever been arrested, but you weren't convicted. Because even if you weren't convicted, we're going to hold that against you, or at least we want to know about it.
No.
Wouldn't that be the easiest way to prove all of this, if it were true?
There was no evidence presented that anyone would hold this against her.
She didn't present information that the Virginia Bar examiners require that all questions be answered fully regardless of dismissals or similar termination, including charges that were not prosecuted?
She did, but there was no evidence that may create a hindrance to her obtaining admittance into law school. The fact that individuals ask is not the same thing as saying that the answer will create a hindrance. My understanding of those of the bar application is that the bar is much more interested in disclosure than they are in what is disclosed. They want to make sure that you do disclose that these things have happened. Again, if that were the case, then there would be no incidences of individuals that obtain admittance into law school who have been charged with, let alone convicted, of either misdemeanor or felony offenses. There's nothing on the record that suggests that that is, in fact, the case, and I think it's actually pretty clear that that is not the case. There is no evidence of a manifest injustice, and again, I believe that you do need to look to the legislative policy to statement to see that it's not just is there any hindrance, but the last line of that is that creates that does unwarranted damage. And that is what I believe the court was looking at when they start to ask the questions of what are the circumstances of this case? Because not only does there have to be a hindrance, but there has to be an unwarranted damage to the individual. If the situation was a citizen who was arrested for assaulting a police officer because they were wearing the same clothing that the officer says that the individual that assaulted him was wearing, and further investigation reveals, nope, wrong guy, and the charge is null pros, that is an innocent individual that is deserving of the protections of the expungement statute because any damage to that individual would be unwarranted. In this situation, I think the court is allowed to look at the circumstances of this individual to determine whether or not the dissemination and the existence of this record creates an unwarranted damage to the individual.
My fear there is, if we're going to do that, shouldn't it work? Does it work in both directions? And then the expungement statute becomes essentially another de facto appeal of what happened earlier. Is there a risk of that if we're going to reopen to say, what were the facts, what actually happened, were you guilty or not? And then we're having these mini trials all over again. That's my fear in that connection.
Just may I answer your question? I think this goes a little bit to the otherwise dismissed language. And I think there is I do believe that there is a common ground, or excuse me, a middle ground, that where an individual is not convicted of a lesser included offense, but the facts and circumstances are significantly related, and it's those operable facts that create the conviction of the amended charge, even though it's not a lesser included. That is a wholly different situation than what this court recognized when there is an amendment to an unrelated and dissimilar charge. Again, I think words have meaning. And when in the case they talk about the conviction being the sole basis, or the operable facts being the sole basis for the new conviction, and in Dresser, where this court said the amendment was to an unrelated and dissimilar charge, if the operable facts give rise to a conviction of an amended charge, I think that is a different situation and not an individual who is solely wholly innocent. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Thomas, would you recite for me the facts in Brown that we found to be as a matter of law, that as a matter of law satisfied the manifest injustice? I can't seem to find them in the opinion.
They're not there.
That's
why we went to the appendix to look them up. Because upon reading Brown, I just wanted to know, okay, what was good enough as a matter of law? And went and looked at the appendix. And essentially, Mr. Brown was a student at Roanoke College. He was going into possibly law school, possibly seeking licensure, called a Series 7 licensure to trade securities, and was very concerned that his assault and battery charge could hold him back. He had obtained an internship at an accounting firm in Roanoke, and he had obtained a low-level position at Bank of America. And the Commonwealth in that case was taking the same position as they take here. You don't have anything to say that you were held back. You're just concerned that you might be. And Mr. Brown was right up front about that. He said, yes, I am. Just as Ms. Anija said to the same question. Yes.
But if that's the law, everybody can say that. Everyone could justifiably say, oh, come on, there's some risk in the future. I can't put my finger on it. I have no evidence on it at all. I can't even bring in an application that says that it specifically would limit me. But we all fear the future, understandably. If that were the case, I don't know how, Mr. Thomas, that doesn't mean that what we would really be saying in so many words is as long as you pass go, you get manifest injustice just because of the risk of the future.
We do not contend that a purely subjective fear of what might happen in the future would be enough under the manifest injustice inquiry. But listen, look at the facts in this case. There was a delay in Disney ABC employment, and I beg to differ with the Commonwealth because it left out some of the questions. From page 34 going on to page 35, Ms. Anija was asked a direct question about when they ran your criminal background check, did the charges show up? And she said, yes, and show the charges. And the question, and did that delay your start date? Answer, yes, it did. And that was not read to you a moment ago. Also, we have to ask ourselves, why does the Virginia Board of Bar Examiners on the Character and Fitness Inquiry ask about charges and convictions? Is it because charges are a positive? No, they are not. And Justice Powell, you touched upon it. It's something where it could be a tiebreaker. It could indeed. And they don't ask about it for no reason at all. They ask about it because it's an issue of concern to them. Same with the California and Virginia law schools, which Ms. Anija checked into. The record indicates that they all ask about charges as well as convictions.
So Virginia law school applications ask about charges absent convictions?
She did a paper and looked into that, and in the paper that she did, the academic paper, it indicated that, yes, they did ask about it.
Your time has expired. The court is adjourned.